you know, I was failing in my marriage. I was failing with my father. I was failing at work. Why was I at this point in my life? You know, what was I doing wrong?
Yeah.
And so as I begin to reflect on my life, and I found myself thinking about what I saw in Bosnia, and I was thinking about what we experienced in my soldiers. And what I discovered is that all of us wants to achieve a level of significance, right? I mean, all of us want to have some kind of meaning in our life, but there's this unknown force that, for whatever reason, when we get a little momentum, and you know what it feels like, Darwin, when you get a little momentum in life and maybe things seem to go well, there's something that tends to disrupt you, you know, something that you do. Sometimes it's self-sabotage. We tend to maybe get in our head a little bit, you know, these things that it just seems like there's this force that always keeps you just one step away where you need to be.
Hello, everyone. This is Darwin with the Darwin's Theories of Awesomeness. And today I have an amazing guest, one of the top speakers in the world, Eric Rehm, also a friend and a mentor and a coach. It was a real privilege to be able to interview him. In his book, he goes through about how he hit rock bottom, and I had a chance to ask him about this interview. He failed his wife and he rejected his daughter, and he throws out his father, suspended from work all at the same time. But through it all, he sort of comes to this idea about rising above chaos and finding significance and how to find purpose with his life, and what a perfect day is, and how he defines that is just amazing, and how he comes to learn to use fear to him and help to make him better, to help make us better, and the insights along those lessons, just amazing. And what was really special to me was to be able to hear from his own words what it was like to talk to former Nazi soldiers and why they fought for Germany and what their purpose was. And just very rich conversation there, and just a lifetime of wisdom. And I learned so much from Eric, a real treat. And I hope you enjoy this interview. The commander of the enemy training camp walked out to face my team and me as we approached his unit. He was flanked by a handful of soldiers, all tense and gripping their weapons. I made a point to sling my M16 semi-auto rifle over my back and raise my hands with my palms facing the commander to let him know that I was not a threat. As I approached him, I unbuckled my helmet and removed it from my head so he could see my face. It further signaled my peaceful intent, because now my hands were occupied with my helmet and could no longer grab my weapon from my shoulder or the 9mm handgun holstered on my right hip. The commander slung his weapon over his shoulder and removed his helmet in response to my gesture. I could feel the tension melt away as we made eye contact. He wasn't much older than me, and I could see the fear in his eyes. My guest today is Eric Rehm, professional speaker and author. He helps busy professional men and women rediscover their passion so that they can redefine their purpose and gain the courage to act. Eric Rehm, you recently released the book Rise Above Chaos, The 5 Principles to Discover Significance and Live in Peace. Eric Rehm, how are you?
Outstanding, man. That was awesome. I never had that open before where someone read an excerpt from my book. In fact, I'm scheduled to do the audio version of my book in May. It's a 3-day journey. I got to read the book, you know, for folks that want to get on Audible. I'm rethinking that. Maybe I should just hire you and have you read it, man. I loved the way you read it. That was fantastic. I want to know what happened there. What's the rest of the story, man? It got me going.
But just a second here. I'm the one here to ask the questions. So what a great book. I read it in 2 sittings. Fascinating. Oh, I couldn't stop turning the pages, and it's packed with wisdom really from your life. And it comes from your heart. And I could feel it when I was reading it. And it seems like it's like a personal journey of reflection, not just others influencing you, but now you also influencing others. Yeah. And the title itself is fascinating, Rise Above Chaos. And there's some difficult stories in there. Like, for instance, you have an operations sergeant that I can only say is how I can imagine an operations sergeant to be. And as you served in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yep.
And thank you for your service. And for a while, it didn't go so well. You said you felt like an utter failure and you felt alone. And yet your operations sergeant is a great mentor to you. And you come to the realization, don't shy away from chaos, rise above it. And that's a lesson that you take. And you know, you talk about hitting rock bottom, but can you tell us about, really, just to start off here, what that title means? Because the title itself is very insightful, I think.
Yeah, well, I believe that, you know, when I left home, Darwin, I was 18 years old. And like, when I say I left home, I like literally left home. I mean, that was it. I remember going to the airport when I was 18 and getting on the plane, and that was back when you could, you know, everybody could, you remember back in the good old days before 9/11, when you just go hang out at the airport, you know? And I, my parents took me to the gate. We sat there together. It was me and my girlfriend at the time. And I remember my parents just sobbing and crying as I was getting on that plane. And it never really, I was wondering what their problem was, you know, never really occurred to me that what they understood that I understood now, that as soon as once I got on that plane, life as we knew it would never be the same. You know, I took off and went to the academy, and that was it. 18 years old, man. I never looked back, and I went out into the world. And, you know, I kept looking for this comfort zone. You know, I kept looking for this mountaintop when I finally made it. And none of that never happened. It seemed like every time, every turn in my life and every phase of my life, there was always chaos just waiting for me. And that's when I realized that that's just life on planet Earth, man. We live in a hostile world, Darwin. And as soon as we wake up and as soon as our feet hit the floor, the world is really stacked up against us. And unless we've got a methodology and we've got a way to address it, you know, we're always going to find ourselves getting knocked down by chaos. And so I just realized at some point in my life, and in a book I talk about, it's in 2005, really, it's when I realized I got to do something different, or I'm never going to thrive in this environment that I find myself in. So I just had to take ownership. And that's what the book's about, is about taking ownership that life is chaotic, but there's a way to rise above it. And when you rise above it, that's where I think your significant life is. But more importantly, that's where you find peace. And that's what I was looking for. And that's what this book's all about.
And you talk about, and you're very vulnerable, and you talk about what you say hitting rock bottom is like. And you paint the picture. Your wife says, and it's heartbreaking because she says, "I deserve better than this." And I had to read this part several times because, in your words, you rejected your wife and your newborn baby daughter. Mm-hmm. And you go on to say, you know, you throw your father out of the house with some harsh words, and then you're suspended from work. So what was that like for you to go through that? If you can describe just, you know, to hit rock bottom like that, what's that like?
Well, I don't really define it much in the book, but the way I tell people is, you know, rock bottom is not really, I think, a set of circumstances. I mean, we're always going to have things that happen to us, Darwin, kind of like, you know, maybe a financial issue or maybe a health issue or, you know, something happening, like you're getting into a wreck or things that happen. All those things happened to me in my life, but those weren't rock bottom moments. To me, rock bottom is when you fail in the major relationships of your life, because I think that at the core of what it means to be a human being, it's about relations and about who we are doing life with. And when you select certain people you're doing life with and you hold really dear to your heart, in this case, it happened to be my dad and my wife and the colleagues that I chose to work with. When you let those close relationships down and you fail in those relationships, that's tough. I mean, you can overcome, you know, something happened to your car. You can overcome a financial situation. It's hard to overcome when you let down your best friend, like that was my wife. And when you let down your best friend, that was my dad as well. My dad was the best man at my wedding. And what made it so hard with my wife is, you know, I literally met my wife at my sister's funeral. You know, it was at a low point in my life when I lost my sister, who was very dear to me, is where I met my wife. And so my relationship started at the casket of my sister. And I took a lot of honor in that. Anytime I could be a good husband, I can honor my sister's memory. So in a way, even after my sister was gone, I was dishonoring her because I was not living up to the expectations of my wife. And so It was tough, man. It was a moment in my life that I start the book out really talking about that, because that was a moment that I had to really make a decision on, really, where am I going to go from here? And that's where my journey started to get back on track.
Wow. Incredible journey. And you're a captain, and your dad calls you in 2000 to call you about your sister, Kimberly, mm-hmm. with whom you're very close. Yeah. And he says, I need you to be strong. Mm-hmm. And you're very close to her. And it's in the acknowledgement, sort of at the end of your book, when you write that you discovered a prayer journal that mm-hmm. she'd written, and you were, you know, pleasantly surprised how many times she prayed, you know, for you and your family. Mm-hmm. And that portion of the book is very interesting. So what does it mean to show up, just showing up? What does that mean to you? If you can explain that to us.
Yeah, that's really good, Darwin. It was March 24th, 2000. And I was still in the Army. I was a battalion S4, which is a logistical officer. So I was in charge of the logistics for my battalion. It was a military police battalion in Fort Carson, Colorado. And I had my bags packed in my car that day. It was a Friday afternoon. I'll never forget because it was a particularly hard week. I was having a, it's sometimes it could be tough being in the military and dealing with all the different things you have to deal with. And it was just a really hard week. And I was supposed to be going snow skiing that afternoon as soon as the day was over. And I couldn't wait to jump in the truck and spend the weekend up in the mountains snow skiing with one of my best friends. And I got a call. That's what my dad said. I mean, those words literally changed the total trajectory of the direction of my life, because it was a pivotal moment in my life. Mainly because my sister was a very solid figure in my life. She was 8 years older than me. We were very close. We talked all the time. She was a foundational relationship that I just looked up to her. And it's one of those things that I knew I looked up to her, but I didn't know I looked up to her as much as I did. And once I realized she was taken away. And I remember my dad said, you have to be strong. And I had to go home. And instead of going to the mountains, I flew home. And on that plane, a couple things. I was very numb. I was experiencing all the emotions. For those that are listening that's lost a loved one, you know what I'm talking about. You go through denial, you're numb. And I don't think it really hit me until we went into the showing where my sister's lifeless body was there. And we got the chance to see her as a family before they opened it up for everybody else to come and pay their respects. And it really didn't hit me until I saw her body. And if you've ever seen someone that's close to you, that you see them when they're no longer alive, didn't look like her anymore. Her spirit was gone. You could just see it, and it hit me. And I just remember just going to my knees and just crying because I realized that she was gone and she wasn't coming back. And then soon after that, we opened up for everybody to come. And when someone dies young, my sister was 34. It was unexpected. And when she died young like that, it's kind of a tragedy. And so the community really showed up. And people started showing up from all walks of life. My sister was a professional dancer, entertainer. She was a really good jazz ballerina. She traveled all the world, really good ambassador to the arts, and she was fantastic. And people from all over the world began to send us letters, and they began to buy all the flowers up in our whole community. We had a community of about 50,000 there, two or three flower shops. They bought up all the flowers. They didn't know what to do, so they started buying statues and just sending us money. And the average wait time for people to pay their respects, Darren, was over 4 hours. So people waited in line for 4 hours. And
wow.
I remember when those people showed up, I don't remember anything they said. You ever go to a funeral, it's hard to find the words. I realize it doesn't matter what you say. I don't remember anything anyone said, but I do remember just the images of those people lining up just to show up to tell them that we're sad. We're sorry. Your sister meant a lot to us. She impacted us. And what's the pivotal moment in that book is that the mayor, and my dad was the chief of police. My dad was chief of police and the mayor. The families were close, where they knew of each other. And the mayor and my dad worked together. And the mayor's wife and the mayor was getting ready to go to the funeral, the showing. And the mayor's daughter, who was early 20s at the time, was in college. And the mayor's wife went up to the daughter and said, we're going to go pay respect to, they called her Kimmy Ream. That's my daughter. That's my wife's, my sister's maiden name. And we're going to go pay respects. I think you should come. And the mayor's daughter said, no, I got finals. I'm studying for college. I don't have time, mom. I'm not coming. Cause she didn't really know. The mayor's daughter didn't know the family very well, but the mom said, no, I think you should come. And she goes, no, I'm not going to come, mom. I got this stuff to study. And then, so the mayor and her wife was leaving. And the last minute, for whatever reason, the mayor's daughter, something changed in her heart and she decided to go. So she went with her mom and dad. She got cleaned up and went with mom and dad. She waited in line for 4 hours like everybody else. And as soon as, she got up to the casket to pay her respects, we met each other for the very first time. So she was 7 years younger than me. Our families had connected every now and then, but I'd never met her before. It was the very first time we laid eyes on each other. And Darwin, within 6 months after that moment, we were engaged and she became my wife 9 months after that. And so even today, we've been married for over 20 plus years and life is great. We have a beautiful relationship. And I honor my sister's memory even today when I'm a good husband and I'm a good father. And I'm reminded of that moment because I realized that my entire life changed because one person showed up. And at the end of the day, that's what life comes down to, is sometimes you just got to show up. When you show up, things happen. In this case, we started an entire life together because of that.
Wow. And I suppose you showed up as well. It was hard, but you showed up as well. And what an honor and commitment to your sister.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the themes that you kind of weave throughout your book is very interesting. You call it the beast, and in the word chaos in the title of your book here, you can see sort of there's an image of you know, eyes of an animal of some kind. And it seems to me, would love to hear your take. It might come, you know, from the trauma of war, because you and your mates saw things that were quite horrific. And you write that you spent several months and the soldiers of your unit had a lot of trouble when they came back, and some of them, you know, hurt one another or maybe their families, which is hard to hear. But you choose to name it, and you call it the beast, and that's a very interesting choice there. And how would you, you know, how can you tell us about that, and sort of how it touched you and your the other mates in your unit?
Yeah, well, the thing is that when I got suspended, because I was in a leadership position. I was a young man, just fresh out of the military. I was in a, you know, fast track at the utility industry I was in. And I got suspended mainly because I was treating the folks I work with like soldiers, and they just weren't having it. And they saw it as abuse of power. Mm-hmm. I saw it as just getting the mission done. Obviously, I lacked self-awareness. And so they told me not to come back to work on Monday. I was going on unpaid suspension. And so I remember waking up on Monday morning when I was supposed to go to work, and I had to do something, Darren. Right? I had this routine. And so I got dressed and I told my wife, I'll be back later. And I just took a drive, and I found myself, and I lived in Colorado at the time. So I found myself driving, and I discovered this small little town called Niwot, Colorado. It's about 15 minutes outside of Boulder, Colorado, just to give a geographic reference. It's about 45 minutes from Loveland, where I was from, where I lived. It was far enough. I got away. I could feel like I can think, but close enough. My wife needed me. I can get home. And I found this really quaint little coffee shop that you see in like a Hallmark movie, downtown Niwot. It's a gorgeous little, adorable little town. And I sat down at the coffee shop and just grabbed a cup of coffee. And I just started to think. I started to contemplate, you know, I was failing in my marriage. I was failing with my father. I was failing at work. Why was I at this point in my life? You know, what was I doing wrong? Yeah. And so as I began to reflect on my life, and I found myself thinking about what I saw in Bosnia, and I was thinking about what we experienced in my soldiers. And what I discovered is that all of us wants to achieve a level of significance, right? I mean, all of us want to have some kind of meaning in our life, but there's this unknown force that for whatever reason, when we get a little momentum, and you know what it feels like, Darwin, when you get a little momentum in life and maybe things seem to go well, there's something that tends to disrupt you, you know, something that you do. Sometimes it's self-sabotage. We tend to maybe get in our head a little bit, you know, these things that it just seems like there's this force that always keeps you just one step away where you need to be. And I realized that that force needed a name. You know, I have a military background, and when you're in a fight, which I believe we are, every time we wake up, we're in a fight in a hostile world. I needed to name it. I needed to give a name. I needed to figure out what this enemy was, this unknown force. And so I began to give it a name, and I started calling it the beast. And I realized that this beast is a voice inside our heads, that it's not just me. You've got it, Darwin. I mean, you and I were talking about, you got a big thing going on tomorrow night in your career, and you're in your head about it. I mean, you're nervous about it. There's some fear. Are you good enough? That's the beast. And, you know, when you go to bed at night, you have that little negative whisper in the back of your head about, hey, you know, your spouse is should respect you more, or your kids or this or whatever. That's just the beast whispering. And sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. and you have a hard time going back to sleep because you can't shut your mind off. That's the beast. And I realized that this is something that we all have to deal with. And my first question was, is do we all have it? And the answer is yes. But the second question is, can I tame it? Because if I'm going to have this force in my life, there's got to be a way around it if I'm going to be successful. And so I was determined to answer that question. It had to be yes. And so that started a journey. It took me about 15 years to really develop a methodology that I can insulate myself from this force that shows up every day. By the way, Darren, it never takes a day off. It's always there. So I couldn't take a day off. So I had to develop a group of habits to protect me from that. And so that's where the beast comes from.
Wow, like it's quite an interesting take to actually name it. And it's interesting you say that you deal with it every day. And you go on to talk about finding your purpose. And you have a take that's quite fascinating to me. And it, honestly, it went in a different direction than I would have predicted. And you talk about your superpower. And you know, I think Batman makes an appearance at some point in your book there, which is awesome. And it came from, you know, a journey for you, but also your friend Dan just makes, you know, says one thing to you. When are you going to do this full time after you just spoken to a group of people and Dan was in the audience? Mm-hmm. And so what is it about the purpose that allows you then to, you know, to push back against the beast, or that helps you to fight against the beast?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that the beast, the way I look at it, this unknown force, and, you know, different books and philosophies and religions call it something different, but I think we all know it's there because it's that thing that keeps us from doing what we're doing. And yeah, part of the tactic of the beast, in my opinion, is to keep us, is to confuse us, to keep us busy doing the wrong things. Right. And so the way that you attack that is having purpose, knowing where you want to take your life, that's going to have an impact. In order to have an impact, though, I discovered there's really a two-part formula. One is passion, right? Because passion is the fuel that helps you rise above chaos. Because in order for you to tame the beast and to cut through the whirlwind of your life and rise above chaos, you're going to need the energy to help you do that, the fuel, if you will. And that's your passion, what you're willing to suffer for. Because at the end of the day, if you don't understand that, then when times get hard, you're not going to have the energy and the resources to rise above it. That's where the passion comes in. However, just having passion alone doesn't help, because I did have passion and that got me in trouble because it was not focused. What focuses it is when you align it with what you're uniquely qualified to do. We all have a unique talent. Darwin, you have some unique skill sets that I just can never touch. I can't get to that. You know, that's not, I don't have that, but I have some talents that you don't possess. But if you take your talent and you align that with your passion, that's where your why begins to form. And so what you're talking about, that story about Dan, way I, how I identify my superpowers is really three questions. And the first question is, what do your friends say about you? You know, the funny thing is, it's amazing when I hang out with talented people, and you and I had a platform where you and I hung out for a while, and you had some mates with you, as you will, if you will, that was going on the journey with you. And it's amazing when you see people like yourself that are very talented, and it's very obvious what you guys are talented in. But when you get in your head, you don't know it, you don't realize it. And sometimes it takes other people saying, you know, you're really good at this, to make you realize, well, maybe he's onto something. And so I did this talk one time. I was doing a talk at an event, and I was doing it for free, and they just asked me to do it. And so I got up and spoke on something, can't remember what it was. And at the end of it, Dan, who I respect, was sitting in the back of the room, and you mentioned it there. After it was done, he took the time, and I'm so glad he did, when he came up to me. And number one, he appraised me and edified me, which was helpful. He said, Eric, you're really good at this. You're a good speaker. I said, thanks, Dan. I appreciate that. And then that's when he asked the question. It never even occurred to me. It's weird when you think back at these things, and that was a pivotal moment. But he said, when are you going to do this full time? I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, when are you going to be a professional speaker? Because I think this is something you could do full time. Up to that point, Darren, no joke, I thought professional speakers were Olympic athletes. Like, you had Donovan Bailey on your podcast. I thought those were the professional speakers, the people that had something significant happen. I didn't think it was regular people like me. That planted the seed. And so that was a pivotal thing. And then, but the key thing, though, is it doesn't become your purpose, though, until you actually take action. And that's the key. You know, you can understand your why, Darwin, but if you never take action on it, it doesn't turn into purpose. It turns into purpose once action is paired with your passion and your superpower. That's the key.
And well, it's, you know, like, fascinating, because sometimes, I mean, we imagine if Dan hadn't sent that to you, and perhaps he's meant to, and as you see, in edifying you. There's another part in your book where that I wanted to ask you, because you had a unique insight into purpose through a different group of people. You were talking to former Nazi soldiers, mm-hmm. and you were talking about, you know, why did they fight for Hitler? Mm-hmm. And I feel their response to you gave a really interesting glimpse into purpose, which we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can take us through that, because I think that's
a
very unique insight.
Yeah. Well, you did really read the book. You're pulling out some stuff that's deep in there. That's fantastic. And so, yeah, it was interesting, because when I redeployed back from Bosnia, I was already thinking about human dynamics, because I saw some things in Bosnia that you can't unsee. You know, I was in Bosnia in the mid-90s, to kind of reacquaint the audience. Mid-90s, it was where the Muslims and the Serbs were literally killing each other. It was like World War II level genocide, where if you were the wrong religion, Darwin, you were executed. And it didn't matter if you're a child, a woman, an elderly man, you were executed and put into a mass grave site. And when you see that, you're like, what was going on? And so I was I was kind of taken aback as a young 22-year-old kid of the darkness, of level of darkness that I saw in Bosnia. It's one thing to read about in the history books, right? It's one thing to read about what happened in Nazi Germany in a history book. Right. It's one thing to watch it on TV, by the way, watch what's going on in Ukraine and see it in the comfort of your home while you're sitting on your couch to see that. It's another thing to be on ground and to taste it and smell it and touch it, right? And so that's where my mindset was when I redeployed back to Germany. And so I decided that I was going to not live on post with Americans. I wanted to live amongst the Germans. And it was funny what I thought about Germany going into it based on what I learned in the history books. It's amazing what we learn and what we're taught. And so I thought of the Germans one way. But I learned that they were totally different once I got a chance to meet them and get to know them. So I lived in the German economy. I lived literally with a German family. I rented out their basement apartment. And about two blocks from where I lived, there was a little like a pub. And I would go there on Friday nights. I would belly up the bar and drink really good German beer and just hang out with these old dudes. You know, remember, this is 1996. And we just got to talking. They didn't speak a lick of English. I didn't speak very good German. And so the more we drank, the better we could communicate. I don't know what it is by lubricating that you can communicate better, but we just started speaking in broken German and English and became friends and got to know one another. And I began to realize as I got to know them that they were actually veterans themselves. They served in the military, but not only they served in the military, but they actually fought in World War II for Nazi Germany. So think about it. This is 1996, so not too far removed from the 1940s, you know. And so we just got to talking and I would see him every Friday. And finally, I felt like I knew him enough that I got the courage to finally ask him, you know, what was going on, man? Why would you guys, you know, fight for that, that you were allowed just a whole population of people to be wiped out?
Yeah.
And I remember them answering and saying, first of all, none of us knew that was going on. And we weren't fighting for Hitler. You know, we were fighting for Germany and we were fighting for our families. And what they explained to me and what I didn't realize is, you know, coming out of World War I, Germany was a lost country, a lost people. They had no purpose. And what I realized, I saw this in Bosnia too, when I saw just young men that were loitering the local towns in Bosnia with no purpose. Mm-hmm. I also realized that my own soldiers, when they lack purpose, they get fidgety. And when you lack purpose, your mind is meant to have a purpose. And if it doesn't have a purpose, it's going to be filled with something. It's either going to be filled with good or evil. And that's where the beast comes in, because the beast comes in and fills it with evil. And so what happened was the Germans, kind of given a summary of this, but the Germans lacked purpose going into the 1930s and late 1930s and early 1940s. And Hitler, who was very charismatic, filled them with a purpose. He gave them purpose. And before they got in too far and they realized what was going on, it was too late. They were fighting the world, and now they were fighting for their very lives. And so that's when I realized that a person without purpose is dangerous, because they're going to figure out something. And a lot of times it's usually destructive. And that's where I found myself in 2005, mm-hmm. as I was filling my life with the destructive lifestyle. And as a result of it, I rejected my family. I rejected my coworkers. I rejected my father. And I found myself in a bad place. And I pulled upon my experiences talking to those Nazi German soldiers that we got to have purpose. And so I had to figure out what my purpose was if I was going to get back on track.
So, and that's fascinating. And how many of us have a chance to have those kinds of insights? And so, and I don't mean to overreach here, but I do honestly wonder about this with, you know, your fellow soldiers when they came back and, you know, perhaps they're harming their families or themselves or one another. What became, was it a lack of purpose there? And then how did you, you know, when you're in communication with them, did you try to bring some sense of purpose to them, you know, after having come back and seen, as you say, the things that you can't unsee?
Yeah, you do the best you can. And it's funny because I actually learned this from my platoon sergeant and the non-commissioned officers. The non-commissioned officers are in the American Army is really the backbone of the Army. These are really career soldiers that are really in the trenches. And I remember, like, when we were in Bosnia and even going back to Germany, the number one way in which you kept a soldier from getting in trouble was keeping him busy, right? Because if you think about in the military, I mean, think about you're having a bad day with a coworker or something, you guys get in an argument. Think about getting an argument with someone who has live ammunition. They have weapons. That's what you're doing with the soldiers. They got live ammunition. They got live weapons. And you're dealing with someone that maybe is unstable at that moment. And so what I discovered is when we went back to Germany, number one, you got to remember I was 23 years old and I'm trying to help these soldiers untangle their lives. And what happened was, is that they came back different than what their spouses remember them. You spend a year away from a loved one, you're not going to be the same coming back after a year of experiences. Add to that, multiply it by 1,000 that you're dealing with the things that these soldiers dealt with in Bosnia. They came back different than what their spouses remember, and their spouses changed as well. And so now they come back and the soldier wants their spouse to be the same when they left. They want their kids to be the same. They want to resume their previous duties that they had. Like, if I paid the bills, you took out the trash, I did the grocery shopping, little things like that just came into conflict. On top of the fact that the soldiers were probably dealing with PTSD, right? Post-traumatic stress syndrome, where they were trying to really just process what they saw and experienced. Put that all together, and it just becomes a peachy drist of just conflict. And so human dynamics is very messy. And if you add that in there, it's like throwing gasoline on it. And so the best you could do in the moment is just try to keep them from harming themselves by keeping them busy. And that's what we did. But that's only a Band-Aid. It takes deeper things than that. But it's a tough thing. I don't think there's always a clear answer. There's just, you do the best you can. And part of that is helping people find purpose. And that's what I had to do. And I realized I'm not alone. If you're a human being, we all struggle with this. And that's why I decided to write the book, is to give maybe some people a roadmap of what they can do if they're finding themselves in a similar experience. Spoiler alert, everybody finds himself here eventually.
Okay. And you go into a part of the book where you describe taming the beast. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I read, I'll take a pause and I'll try and anticipate what the author is going to write and then see if I'm right. And inevitably I'm wrong in a good way.
Yeah.
And you talk about the perfect day. And so when if I was, you know, to be asked what the perfect days look like, and I might think, you know, it's a walk on the beach, I'm along the ocean, it's clear blue skies, but that's not what you're saying here.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so when you talk about the perfect day, you know, you make a very interesting point about taking personal responsibility. That's kind of your statement there. Mm-hmm. And so what to you, if you were to sum up the perfect day, what does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the perfect day, the way I can summarize it is to identify what it's not. And what you just described is what it's not, because the way you described a perfect day is a perfect set of conditions. Yeah. And that's not, you can't control that, right? You can actually have the perfect day in your darkest moment, actually. A loss of a spouse that you were married to for 25 years who passed away of terminal cancer could be a perfect day for you, because of how you approach the day and how you manage it. And there's different parts of this, the human experience, that with your attitude, with your energy levels, with living within your purpose, those type of things that you have control over, that if you do those things every day, depending on what's going on around you, the whirlwinds, the chaos, the conflict, gas prices, a child that's really just not getting life at that moment, a car wreck, a financial issue you have no control over, if you still control the things you control, your attitude and how you approach your life, you can live the perfect day more often than not. And what I'm trying to say is that all of us experienced a day where it just seemed like everything was clicking. And those are beautiful days, man. And when you go to sleep that night, you know, man, today was a really good day. But the problem is you just don't have many of those, because it just seems like life always is throwing you a curveball. Well, I said, my thought was, is why not? Why couldn't I have more of those? And what is it? What would it take for me to do that? And it took me really 15 years to land on what I believe are the 7 elements of the perfect day. And it's really not less about the conditions and more about what's going on inside and how you approach your life that way.
Amazing. So you talk about fear, and the perfect day is, you know, some kind of counteraction to that in some way. Mm-hmm. And there's something as I, you know, went through the book that I didn't quite reconcile and might at the surface seem like a contradiction. I would love to hear what your thought is on this. And so, If the beast, you know, might be a primary fear or something like that. And in another part of the book, you write about how fear is like a motivator. Mm-hmm. It's a stress, and it leads to a paradigm shift, and it causes you to make a change. And so on the one hand, it's like a primary fear that we have to fight against. And on the other hand, it's sort of like a motivator that drives us forward. And so I wanted to ask you about that and just get your take on how you saw sort of the, maybe the duality of fear.
Yeah. Well, it's not a necessarily a motivator in a positive way. It motivates and influences your decisions, what the point I was making there. And we all live with fear because fear is our way of surviving. Without it, we couldn't survive. That's how our ancestors survived. Our ancestors survived by being in fear of being hunted by predators. And so when we feel fear, that motivates us to do the things we need to do to survive. So when our ancestors were alive, they were just trying to think about if we had a day planner 2000 years ago, we'd have one thing we want to accomplish every day. And that would be alive at the end of it. That was a successful day for our ancestors. Well, that level of survival was passed down from generation to generation. So you still have that same level of instinct to survive. And fear is what motivates your instincts to, like, your spidey senses. That's going to for you to do the things you need to do to survive whatever it is. Now it's more sophisticated now. So a fear for you could be a new boss. A fear is that gig you got tomorrow and whether or not you're going to be able to meet up, match their expectations. That's a fear. Now what the beast does is it tries to take that fear and use it against you. The difference is, do you allow the beast to use it against you, or do you allow it as a way for you to make the changes or influence you in a way in the positive? You see, the beast can take it and make it a negative. The beast can take that fear that you have, Darwin, on that thing you have to do tomorrow, and can make you so incapacitated by it that you're going to get up and really bomb because the beast will not get out of your head. Or can you use that fear to prepare so hard that when you get up there, you got that thing down pat, you are over-prepared, you are ready to go because the fear of failing was so much so that you wanted to overcome that. So the beast is used as a tool, just like anything else. A knife is a tool that could be used for good or evil. A weapon is a tool that could be used for good or evil. The beast wants you to use it for evil. Are you going to use it for evil or not? That's the key.
Very good. And so do you consciously weave this into, you know, how you construct your perfect day? And it sounds like you use this on a daily basis to motivate yourself.
Definitely. In fact, the fundamental thing I talk about with anybody that goes to my workshops is I tell them that in its fundamental core, I believe every human being, the primary motivator we have is fear. Fear influences every decision we make. So when I wake up every day, fear is waiting for me in a healthy way. It should be, because that's how I'm going to make decisions that's going to impact my family, is to understand that there are some things that I have to address if I want to be successful. The key is how do I manage that fear? And I have to manage it with the right proper priorities. I got to manage it with the right energy. I got to manage it with basically using my strengths instead of using my weaknesses. That was my problem, is I was trying to do too much and realizing I'm only good at a certain few things. Why not just lean into that? So when I started to tick these things off, I was able to manage it in a right way. It's never going to go away. In fact, I don't want it to go away. If I'm living a life where I fear nothing, that's also dangerous too, because then there's no consequences anymore in my world. You know, fear has consequences. That's what we fear. We fear the consequences. You fear failing tomorrow because the consequences of maybe not being able to speak again, maybe losing the respect of the people in the room. Those are consequences on the other side of fear. So you want to have that in a healthy way, but you want to be able to be equipped to manage it as well. If not, then the beast is going to consume you with it.
Amazing stuff. Amazing. And you're very open and vulnerable in the book, you know, warts and everything. And
my dad said the same thing, by the way. He's like, man, Eric, you talked a lot in here. In fact, I'm in here, Eric.
I'm sure. I was wondering if he read it, actually, and your wife as
did.
Well.
Yeah. In fact, he's my greatest supporter. He goes by my house and grabs 5 or 6 books and takes them out and sells it to people, sells it to his neighbors. He comes back with cash. Hey, I sold more of your books. So he's personally trying to keep me a bestseller. So he's a good dude.
We all need dads like that. Hey, that's awesome. Yeah. And another story you tell is about embracing your scars, basically.
Yeah.
And some people report you, and a fellow soldier, you know, reports an accusation that tends to be false about, you know, your pay, mm-hmm. your paycheck.
Yeah.
And it causes you to withdraw a little bit, and you're an extrovert, but it maybe causes you to doubt yourself for a while there. And I can only imagine. I mean, that's a challenging situation, because it sounds like it's from someone that you trust mm-hmm. and trusted.
Yeah.
So what does it look like to embrace your scars, you know, and still to be, you know, able to trust and yet in some way to protect yourself at the same at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things, I think it was my dad, could have been somebody else, but I remember someone telling me that you should never trust somebody who doesn't walk with a limp, because that means that that person hasn't lived a life. And so if you live in, on planet Earth and you live the human experience, you're going to have some bumps along the road, and some of those bumps are going to leave a mark, right? And you, it changes the way you look at things, right? Like when I went to Bosnia, it changed the way I looked at people. I was pretty naive about people going into that. And one of the things I talk about in the book, my passion is people. I love people. So ever since I was a kid, I've always been fascinated by people. I love being around people. You know, if I go into a room of 30 strangers, that's just a room of 30 potential friends. I want to get to know them. I want to find out what makes them tick. Well, what happened to me was, is it was people that got me in trouble, right? I got suspended because a group of people came together against me. And when I was in Germany, there was an investigation I talk about in the book where there was an investigation about how I was getting paid. And so I don't want to bore the audience, but the bottom line is it was somebody I trusted ultimately that reported me to criminal investigation division. And they also mm-hmm. ultimately did an investigation. It was very stressful. Even though I knew I was right, it was hurtful because it was like, they should know me. The guy that reported me should know me that that was not me. And it was honestly just an honest clerical mistake that was cleared up, but it did leave a mark. It left a scar. And there's times where I'm thinking, why put myself out there if this is what people do? Because at the end of the day, people will hurt you out of their own fears, jealousies, whatever, why people do what they do. But in our line of work, by the way, you and I are both speakers. You're putting yourself out there every time you get on stage. Yeah, you know, yeah. This book, putting that book out there puts me out there for people to criticize, to say things. Yeah. And when you do that, that leaves a mark. But here's the thing. What I talk about in the book is that those scars are part of your story. And if you embrace your scars, you embrace your story, that is encouraging for others and it's healthy for you. It's healthy for me to embrace, hey, this is my journey. Don't shy away from it. It's a part of who I am. And how can I leverage that for the good? By the way, that's a tool of the beast. The beast wants me to walk away from that, because if it does, it takes me further away from what my passion is. If I walked away and resigned with the fact that people are generally bad people, and if I don't put myself out there, I won't get any more scars, then I'm doing exactly what the beast wants me to do, because I was meant to go out and be in front of people and communicate. Okay. So you have to overcome that, embrace your scars, lean into that. And then by doing that, what happens is my story, your story, Darren, because you have a set of scars that you have to embrace. Your story is going to impact someone. It's going to encourage someone. And if you encourage someone, then guess what? You may change their life for the better. And the beast doesn't like that. The beast doesn't like it when you make an impact like that.
So what happened afterwards then? Did you, you know, with your buddy or your fellow soldier, whoever it was, what happened afterwards, knowing that was him, and after you were cleared then?
Well, after I was cleared, I just moved on. I never saw him again because he was back in Germany. I've never seen him since. So I'd love to see him again and ask him, you know, why'd you do that? But, you know, what I've learned is that once you understand what motivates people, Darren, you're no longer offended by him anymore. In fact, that's why I tell people in my workshops is one of the things I want to teach you is, if you're still offended by what people do, then you haven't mastered human dynamics. Mastering human dynamics is getting to the point to what people do no longer surprise you. And so I get less and less surprised by people because I understand their motivations more. And the motivations are fear. People are motivated by fear, meaning that they are motivated to try to escape fear the best way they possibly can. Unfortunately, some people do it in a very negative way, like reporting to somebody else of something they didn't do, because it's a fear that it helps alleviate their own fears. So what they do is they project out on others, right? That's why people who can't process fear in a healthy way end up doing things that harm others, doing things that harm society. What's going on in the Ukraine, that's a whole set of fears that are being addressed in an unhealthy way. That's what life is. And that's why, to the crux of this book, I think if people can learn to manage their own beasts, their own demons, their own fears, the world would be a better place if you could work through that. Like, for instance, if I did not make those changes in 2005, who knows if I'd still be married? That means that my sons would have never been born. Or actually, my sons were brand new at the time. I'm sorry. My sons would have been, they just got born. That means they would have grown up without a father at home. Mm-hmm. Who knows what the impact that would have had on them, right? Yeah, yeah. What kind of destructive lifestyle would I would have continued, and what kind of negative impact would I had on others? What would have been the ripple effect of that if me, one person, would not have made that change? Well, what if you multiply that by 1,000 people? What if 1,000 people are affected by this book, and 1,000 people make a difference because of what they read in the book? And then how do they affect you know, 1,000 other people. And it becomes mind-boggling if you think about the ripple effect. If one individual decides they're not going to let the beast dominate the world anymore, and then multiply that by 1,000, 100,000, it's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, those ripple effects. And I mean, bless you for writing this book and so many insights. And I can't possibly do this interview without mentioning someone named Patsy.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And she joined something called Home Interior and Gifts.
Yeah.
Early on, and we're going back here. And she was in deep, deep financial trouble.
Yep.
And someone named Mary Crowley says to her,
yep,
takes her aside and specially says to her, you're going to be a success in this business. And years later, you know, talking about the effect that we have on people, that has an effect on you when you have a conversation with her. So I would love to hear this story in your words here.
Oh, that's, yeah, man, I'm so glad you brought to this. It's a wonderful story. Patsy, you know, she, Home Interiors and Gifts was a multi-level marketing company that ruled the business world, that industry in the 80s and 90s. It was started by a lady by the name of Mary Crowley, who was a single mother in Dallas, Texas. She was a survivor of the Great Depression. She started this business out of her garage of her home in Dallas, Texas. And the whole premise was she wanted to give women at the time, and this is in the 50s, she wanted to give women who were predominantly back in those days were stay-at-home moms. She wanted to give them a mechanism to create financial wealth so they could support their families, but also be full-time mothers. And so my Patsy, she grasped that vision in 1973, and she became what they call a branch, or I can't remember, director in 1983. So in 10 years, she got to the point where she was at a director level, which meant she got to go up to Dallas, Texas and get personally trained with all the other new directors all over the country by Mary Crowley herself. By this time, Mary Crowley was at a really high state in her life. She was very successful. She was rubbing shoulders with the political elites, the social elites. She bought the Dallas Mavericks NBA team. She bought the bank that loaned her the money back in 1953. Wow. She was a big deal. And so Patsy was in a room with hundreds of other women from across the country. And three different occasions in that training, Mary Crowley on that day in 1983 called Patsy out by name. And that really boggled Patsy's mind, because Mary Crowley was such a big deal. How did she know Patsy? And when it was done, after the session was done, she pulled Patsy aside, made a point to pull her aside. And she whispered in her ear so only Patsy could hear, Patsy, you're going to be huge in this business. And that sent tingles down her spine, because what Mary Crowley didn't know in that moment, as Patsy was in a deep despair in her life, she was struggling in her own marriage. She was in deep financial despair to the point that she had contemplated suicide, literally thought that maybe it's better if I just end my life. Wow. But when Mary Crowley said those words, Patsy, and Mary Crowley was Patsy's hero at this point. Think about your hero coming to you in your darkest hour and whispering in your ear, Darwin, and saying, you know what? You're worth it. You're going to be huge. That's all Patsy held on to until she could get her life back on track. Well, 17 years later, after Mary Crowley said those words, Patsy found herself back in Dallas, Texas, on stage being awarded the top 10 biggest business in the entire country. 17 years later, Patsy's life was turned around, but not only was she worth it, but she was one of the best in the country. The cool thing about that story is Patsy's my mother. And if you think about it, at the time in 1983, I was 10 years old. If my mother would have ended her life, what would my life look like? But because one person took the time, when she didn't have to, she pulled Patsy aside and breathed those words of encouragement to her. Now, fast forward 30 some years later, I find myself at West Point, at a dark point where I thought I wanted to quit. I called my mother, Patsy, right? I called her home and said, Mom, I don't think I can make it. This is too hard. It wasn't what I expected. And my mom, with all her wisdom, fought her motherly instincts and said, Eric, I know what you want me to say, but I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to give you permission to come home. Instead, here's what I want you to do. I want to encourage you to give it 1 year. And if you just give it 1 year, you're going to find your groove at West Point. You're going to make some lifelong friends, and you will regret if you walk away in this moment. She said, give me 1 year. And then 1 year from the day, if we still need to have this conversation, then I'll give you permission. We never had that conversation, Darwin, because she encouraged me to lean into it. My mom would never have been there to encourage me in that moment if Mary Crowley in 1983 wasn't there for my mom to encourage her. And I call it the world belongs to the encourager. And the power of encouragement is like wildfire. You can't keep it inside. And so when you encourage someone, that person goes out and encourages another person, and that person goes out and encourages another person. And my mom has been one of my primary encouragers my entire life because one person took the time to encourage her. So the point of that whole story is, how many times do you walk past somebody who just needs to hear you're good enough? And Mary Crowley was the queen at that. And my mom passed that on, and I hope to be that same person. So that's the story around Patsy, and it's a beautiful story. And hopefully my mom will hear this. My mom listens to all the podcasts. So a big shout out to my mother. She's a beautiful lady, and she's been huge in my life. And the whole book starts off with that story about my mother, which is fantastic.
Well, Patsy, thank you for having that conversation. This is Eric Bream, and you've encouraged us. And Patsy, you've encouraged us through Eric. So thankful to both of you. And from the beginning of the book and to the end, you talk about finding peace. And brother, I can hear it, and I can feel it just coming out of you and right through the camera. And it's been such a pleasure, just incredible insights. And we've talked a lot here, and we've covered a lot, and yet we've only just touched the surface. And so whoever's listening to this, make sure you get the book and read it, because it's so amazing. Rise Above Chaos by Eric Ream. Thank you so much.
Amazing interview. And I really enjoyed interviewing Eric, and I came away with so many thoughts and nuggets of wisdom and quotes. And he talks about mastering human dynamics, getting the point where no matter what people do, he doesn't get surprised anymore, really. And about Eric himself, how he defines his own perfect day as being able to take personal responsibility. So not a set of conditions, but really being able to control the things that are inside of your control and be able to do that. It's a great day. It's a perfect day. And it was amazing to me how we talked about having the perfect day, even when someone in our family passes. And he tells a story about how he loses his sister and how devastating that is. And yet it turns into something amazing for him and his family. And get the book. It goes into great detail, more detail about what happens there in that situation. And how he uses fear in a way that's constructive and taking us through his journey in life, where initially it's really a destructive force and works against him, but then he learns to turn it into something that's very powerful and meaningful, and every day using it in a healthy way. And I love the quote, never trust someone who walks without a limp. And that was so good. So good. And I was left with a thought at the very end. He said, you know, how many times you walk past somebody who just needs to hear that you're good enough, and just, you know, words of wisdom, you know, from his mom, Patsy, and from the words that she hears from Mary Crowley. And that was so amazing, and how it's passed on to Eric, and how his friend just with those few words, it completely changes his life. And I feel like that Eric blessed me and hopefully blessed you with those words of wisdom too, because just it's those ripple effects and making just little ripples that make us all better and encourage us just a little bit. And I found that so positive and so encouraging. And just how he learned to embrace the scars in his journey, and that was so good. And you know, I'm a speaker and I'm a coach now, and Eric was a great mentor to me and a coach, and I'd consider my life much richer for having encountered him. It's so grateful for the time and being able to interview him. Just a fantastic experience, and I hope you got as much out of it as I did. Have a great day, a perfect day.